Oh, it's great to have you with us. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, recently on Life and Faith, we spoke to John Dixon, our fellow director here at CPX, about his 100-page challenge. This was the idea that everyone ought to give the Bible at least 100 pages. Give it a go for that length of time. It's the best-selling book in history by a long way. It's shaped Western culture in profound ways, and it's a literary classic. But, admittedly, it's not the easiest book to just dive into, partly because it's a collection of more than 60 books written at different times, in different places, and even in different languages.
John Dixon wants to make it easier for people to be able to find their way around the Bible. So he's got a book coming out in 2015 called A Doubter's Guide to the Bible, Inside History's Bestseller for Believers and Skeptics. John's with us to discuss the book. Welcome to the program, John.
Thanks for having me.
It's an intriguing title. Tell us how it's a book for doubters.
Well, there are tons of people who think the Bible might be important, maybe, culturally, and maybe even spiritually, but just aren't sure whether it's true, on the one hand, whether it's relevant, on the other, or even how to get your head around this book. It's such a big book. It's really a guide leading people who aren't sure if it's true through the whole biblical narrative in a way that just sort of poses, what would this mean for life if it were true? So I want them to see what it would mean, how it would impact life and how it shapes current culture. If it were true, this is a special vision of life. I've written other books that are, you know, here's the evidence for Jesus Christ and so on, but this is quite different.
Kind of about the coherence of the whole thing.
Coherence of the narrative and what it would mean for life if these ideas were true.
It's a quite short book, yours. It's very accessible, but it's about, obviously, a very long book. How do you cover everything in such a short tome?
Well, yeah. Fortunately, the Bible has a pretty coherent narrative. And so as long as you stay on track with the main story, I think it's pretty easy. You could summarize the Bible in, you know, 1,000 words if you want. So trying to do it in 30,000 words or however long the book is, I'm not sure. It was actually pretty easy, even though you know you've left out tons of stuff. So there are tons of things in the Bible readers won't get to hear about in my book, but they will have the general plot line from beginning to end clearly in mind, in a way that if they choose to then read the Bible, even if they deal with a part of the Bible I haven't dealt with, they'll actually, hopefully, have a sense of how that must fit with the general plot line, because everything fits.
John, Christians don't always agree on the interpretation of the Bible. Some people dismiss the Bible altogether because they feel that really you can make it say anything you want to. How do you approach this issue of the disagreement of what the text actually means?
There's no doubt Christians have disagreed on all sorts of interpretations of specific parts of the Bible. But fortunately, as you look back through Christian history, there's general agreement about the main plot of the Bible, which is why, you know, Christians of all denominations can still say those creeds like the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, because Christians agree on the big stuff. God created the world, humanity fell, God started to redeem us, you know, through Israel. This all pointed to Jesus. Jesus came, he died, he rose. He's coming back to bring a kingdom and he'll judge the world and people will live forever in his kingdom, right? So there's the plot line. And there's profound agreement on that. On the edges, sure, there's disagreement. But that isn't to say you can make the Bible say whatever you want it to say. That's just a cop-out, actually. Whenever I hear people say that, it's more like they don't want to read the Bible. The Bible is like any book. There is a spectrum of interpretation, but you can't make books say whatever you want them to say. You can't, you know, make Darwin's Origin of Species say whatever you want it to say. You can't make Shakespeare say whatever you want it to say.
At some point, you're going to be way wrong. Like, you could read my novel and there'd be different interpretations or it mean different things to different people, but at some point you might say to me, and this is saying this, right? And I'll say, actually, no, John, you're wrong about that. Yeah. Nothing to do with it.
There are parameters to interpretation is what I'm saying, yeah.
Now, A Doubter's Guide to the Bible takes us through the whole thing from Genesis to Revelation. It's a bit like you, mate, taking on these sort of big projects. But you're going to be the tour guide for this book. We're going to take this sort of road trip. And so in Life and Faith, what we want to do over the next 3 weeks, it's a bit ambitious, but we want to go through the whole Bible with you helping us to sort of offer a kind of framework that no matter where you want to dip into the Bible, you can make a bit of sense about what's going on and what it all means. Now, next week, we're going to look at that part of the Bible, it's about two-thirds of it, called the Old Testament. And the week after that, we're going to look at Jesus and the New Testament, what that means and what we can learn about him. But this week, we're going to get right into the Bible at the very beginning, the first few chapters. These can be quite controversial chapters, of course. But John, jumping in right at the beginning, what do you think is the most important thing for people to remember as they open Genesis 1 and start reading?
Probably that ancient people did not think about the scientific mechanics of creation. That just wasn't in their heads. So whatever we make of the Genesis 1 narrative, it's inappropriate to think it must be about scientific origins, because that's a modern question. It wasn't an ancient question. And so we need to look for the questions that ancient people did look for. And I think it's pretty clear. And all sides of the debate about the meaning of Genesis 1 have to agree the main point is that an ordered good God has made an orderly good creation in which human beings are the, if you like, the pinnacle, who are granted care over this creation on God's behalf since they bear his image. So the goodness of the physical order is the main point. And it is such a contrast to other stories of creation that existed in the ancient world, which did not think the world was a good place.
You do often hear people say that all these old creation myths borrow from one another and that shows that really they're all as made up as each other. How does the Bible's creation story relate to other things that were written at the same time?
Most agree that there are real connections between Genesis and other creation stories of the Babylonians or the Egyptians or whatever. And there was early debate 150 years ago when these other creation stories were discovered. There was debate about whether Genesis had just borrowed. It was a completely unoriginal account that scratched around from other cultures to come up with what it thought of creation. Over the years, the scholarly consensus has moved to think, actually, the Bible looks incredibly sophisticated, not like it's nervously borrowing from other cultures, but that it's very confidently saying, you think that, but here's the truth. You think that, here's the truth. And it's the you think that connects Genesis with other creation accounts. So it does borrow things like the beginning of the Genesis account starts with water, a watery chaos. Well, that's quite a common feature of other creation stories. And so you think, has that borrowed it? Or is the writer of Genesis using a common notion of creation in order to make a particular point? And that does seem to be what the creation narrative is doing. It's borrowing some elements and turning them into theological statements. I mean, one classic example is the way one God is named throughout the whole thing, and he's just given the name God. He's not actually given a personal name. It's just God this, God that, God this, God that. When all the other creation narratives have multiple gods, and ancient readers would have read Genesis 1:1 as quite a controversial statement. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, which leaves nothing for anyone else to do, right? So in the opening line, a huge swipe at belief in multiple gods. Other pagan narratives had multiple gods making the creation. Genesis says, nope, it's one God.
Well, we've got the whole Bible to get through, John, but we want to move on. But do you want to say anything else about that creation story?
Well, the fundamental thing, other than, you know, there's one God, is that it's a good creation. And that is really, really striking. And the author of Genesis 1 is super keen that you spot it, because seven times the author says, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. And then the last one says, and it was very good, just, you know, for the dummies. And this was hugely contrasting with creation narratives that existed, where the creation was like an afterthought, bits and pieces of the wars of the gods. Certainly not a beautiful work of art that is good. But the Genesis says, no, this creation stuff is good.
Well, one of the foundational stories of Western culture is the biblical account of what's often called the fall, where Adam and Eve eat the forbidden fruit of the Garden of Eden. Now, what's this all about? Is it naive individuals gaining knowledge and then therefore freedom? Is it about sex? Is it supposed to be real history? What's going on?
Well, these are huge topics that need more conversation than just the minutes we can cover. But again, people would agree that the main point of the fall narrative, the Adam and Eve story, is that human beings take it upon themselves to determine good and evil. That's what's going on in the garden. There are very sensible Christian scholars who take the story as a perfectly historical narrative, and there was real fruit and all that. And then there are very sensible, respected scholars who take it more like a parable. Either way, and I certainly fit into the second category, but either way, we have to agree that they're choosing to take from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is a decision to be able to determine good and evil for themselves. That's the great evil that's going on here. You're not God. I'm God. I choose good from evil. God, you can get lost. And that's the universal story. Everyone agrees with that. Human beings deciding that they are the determiners, the knowers of good and evil instead of God. We do that every day, but it is our human history.
In your book, John, you talk about the fall in terms of why so much is bad, which seems quite a pertinent theme to, you know, we read the news every day and kind of wonder why so much is bad. How does this ancient story resonate with what we see around us today?
Well, it allows us to live without the, I think, oppressive myth that we are good through and through. I would hate to believe that I was good through and through, because I frankly don't know how I could live with all the counter evidence in my life on a daily basis. You know, and when I see, you know, the wrong in my own life, imagine if I had to go, oh no, I'm really good. You know, it was just my behavior that let me down, right?
It's kind of liberating to be able to say I'm not necessarily a good person.
It's liberating in the sense that it explains who I am. And the other, I think, beautiful thing about the notion of the fallenness of humanity is that it creates a humility and a leveling of humanity. Now, it's true that Bible people have been world experts at judging others in history at that point. But when Christians have taken seriously this notion that we're all fallen, that we're all Adam and Eve, it's a great leveler. So I can look at another person and, you know, even in their fallenness, I recognize my own fallenness. And so I lose all basis for judging another when I know that I am, in biblical language, a sinner. I'm not a righteous person as opposed to the sinful people out there. I myself am a fallen character. And that perfectly sets us up for relationships of care and humility toward each other, because there aren't winners and losers, good and bad. There are just people who are fallen, in need of each other, and above all, in need of God's grace.
And in those early chapters, we get this picture that's both of humanity that's fallen, but nonetheless immensely valuable because they're made in the image of God. And you have to hold those things in tension, don't you?
And the Bible really does. And I think human culture has not been able to hold these two things together in the way the Bible does. So in some human cultures, there was the view that creation is basically all bad, and that humans are all bad. They're all just subservient nothingness. And frankly, the modern evolutionary myth is that human beings are just, you know, worth the minerals in their body. We were an accident, after all. We weren't intended in the universe. So any meaning or value we find is just created by us, right? So there's a sense in which the ancient myth of our uselessness as creatures is mirrored by the modern myth of our basic accidental nature. Whereas the Bible says, no. We're high and holy creatures, but we have fallen. But we haven't fallen to the point that there's nothing good in us. And so it's that ability to hold it together. And when churches function at their best, they are holding both things in mind. They see the image of God in every human being, and they see fallenness in every human being.
Well, having set the scene for all of human history, next week we're going to dive into the Old Testament, the laws, the prophecies. John, we're looking forward to talking to you more about that.
It's going to be thrilling.
This is the Doubter's Guide to the Bible. Really looking forward to having your company next time on Life and Faith.